All right, we are going to have, I think, two more classes. Did I say that last week? I was trying to remember if I... Okay, good. So, leave it to Matt, I tell you. But I'm hoping that we'll work our way up to the King James version here tonight, and then next week sort of make a comparison between the King James and the more modern translations that we have. And that will pretty much wrap up a history of the English Bible. And so that will be it for this series of lessons. And as we look at the English Bible, again, all of this information should be very exciting to us on a certain level. I mean, I'm not expecting you to jump up and down, but I mean, these are important things, and we're really blessed beyond measure to be able to have the Bible. And there are people right now, as you know, in various places that don't have access to the Word of God. And so we do, and we're just so fortunate for that. Hopefully, we study it, take advantage of it like we ought to. But it's just a blessing to have it. And men like William Tyndale gave their lives so that that could be a reality. Gave his life for people he didn't know. He was just interested in the common man and wanting the common man to have the Bible. And so we really should be thankful for these men. And a lot of them, we don't even know who they were, but played a part in us having the English Bible. And so we've gone through this, and we've seen that in 1526, he had his New Testament a copy of the English Bible that he made and snuck it into to England. But the important thing is, at that time, we had, for the first time, people being able to read the Bible in English, in their own language in England. And then we come to Miles Coverdale. Remember, he was the associate of Tyndale and had a similar, not exactly, but similar education at Cambridge. And he, while Tyndale was, after he was arrested, he was in the process of completing what Tyndale started. And so he produced a complete Bible. And Tyndale could only do the New Testament and a very small portion of the Old Testament. Remember Genesis or the Pentateuch and then the book of Jonah, later redid Genesis. But There's some evidence that Tyndale also translated some of the historical books of the Old Testament, though we don't have record of it. We don't have copies of it. We don't know exactly which ones he did, but he was arrested and everything before he could get that out. But Coverdale came and completed his work, and then so he produced a complete Bible. And as we were looking at, I think last week, we started to look at what these little pole-like things represent. They're just pointing to the source of some of these Bible translations. And so Coverdale is, you can see, obviously, his work basically is the work of Tyndale. And really, most of these are. They all go back to Tyndale. That's why he's the father of the English Bible, because they're revising his work. And sometimes there's very little difference other than a few revisions in certain texts from his text. And so, again, that's why he's the father of the English Bible. But Coverdale did a great service in producing that. And so we looked at his Old Testament. I think last week we again covered some of this. But his Old Testament was based on Luther's German translation, which is sort of interesting to me. Ulrich Zwingli's Zurich Bible, and also, of course, the Latin Vulgate was the basis of his Old Testament. Because remember, Tyndale didn't, again, as I just said, didn't complete the Old Testament. So he had to go to other sources, and that's what he did. Then we come to John Rogers and the Matthew's Bible, or the Matthew Bible. And again, that was a very valuable work, just another step forward up the list. It was published in 1537. And it's a combination of Tyndale's and Coverdale's translation. So nothing new, but his is a combination of those. And he gave his life ultimately for the cause as well. And remember, Tyndale, he gave his life, but if you recall, he was strangled. And not that this matters too much, they all died. But as I read the history of William, you know, you're kind of reading it and you feel relief that they strangled him before they burned him. Because I don't know about you, but I believe I'd rather be strangled than burned to death. And but a lot of these folks, like John Rogers, were actually they burned them to death, and that's just a terrible way to die, I would think. But the courage of these individuals to go through that, it brings us to then the Great Bible, and the Great Bible. Again, it's called great because of its size. I think I told you that last week. But also, it's great because it was the first authorized English Bible. And the way that really came about was, in some of those other translations over there, the Matthew and the Coverdale, all of those Bibles had notes in them that these translators, they basically... A lot of them, particularly when we get to the Geneva Bible, but all of them had notes almost like our study Bibles. And so, you know, you get our modern Bibles today. Many of you have study Bible. Maybe most of you have a study Bible. And you have to be careful about those things because the study Bibles will reflect the theology of whoever it is that's doing it. Whoever's publishing it a lot of time or whoever's putting it together. And so, like, they say the ESV is very Calvinistic. And I've heard that ever since I started using the ESV. And, well, there's some verses in the ESV that are translated in such a way that you might think, well, that's kind of Calvinistic. But they're very few, really. I mean, I haven't come across a lot of them like that at all. I can hardly even tell. In fact, if I didn't hear that, I might not even think of Calvinism as I study through my ESV Bible. But in the study Bible of the ESV, all of the notes will lean towards Calvinism. And so that's why they call it very Calvinistic Bible. Well, in these Bibles, it was the same way. They had in the Matthew and the Coverdale, they had a Reformation doctrine, which basically meant they espoused the John Calvin's doctrine, which is Calvinism. Whether it was actually called Calvinism back there or not, it was Calvinism, and so there were many people that opposed that. And so Henry VIII was getting some pressure to get a new translation that didn't have that leaning towards it. And so he authorized some of the ministers, chancellor, Thomas Cranmer, I believe, was the Lord Chancellor, that he authorized him to start a new translation. And he got, believe it or not, Miles Coverdale to do it. So Miles Coverdale began to edit a new translation, but he went back to Matthew's Bible. Instead of using his own, for whatever reason, he used Matthew's Bible as the base. And the result of it all was the Great Bible. It is what they ended up producing was the Great Bible, revision again of Matthew's Bible. And last week, we'll not go through all of this again, but we kind of covered how it all came about, because it is quite shocking that King Henry now is authorizing a Bible. And I might want to point out that the Matthew Bible and the Coverdale Bible, things have greatly changed, but not completely. But those were what they say. They were licensed Bibles. So that they weren't persecuted at all when they were putting them out, and they had the authority behind them, but they weren't authorized versions. The authorized versions were the versions that now they sent out and could be read in church services. And they were to be read in church services. And so there were basically three authorized Bible when it was all said and done. And the Great Bible was the first one. But anyway, we went through this where King Henry married Catherine. He grew tired of her. He was basically a womanizer and unfaithful and all of that. You remember why he wanted the annulment? What was the big problem? I'm sorry? Yes, he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. But what did he? Why? I mean, what did he say about Catherine? She couldn't bear any sons. Couldn't bear any sons. Now, the real truth was he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. But there was probably some truth to the idea that he was upset that he didn't have an heir. I'm not going to dismiss that altogether. It was very unusual. All he had was a daughter, and it was very unusual for a woman to become, you know, the head of England. And in fact, it had never been done, I don't believe. There's no doubt he really wanted a son, but he really had his eye on Anne Boleyn. And so he eventually got what he wanted, but was excommunicated by the Pope because of it. We kind of went through that last time. And then so he initiated this act of supremacy, which basically was the establishment of the Church of England. We often put up, when we're preaching on the church, we'll put up this chart, be a little bit longer, but all of how denominationalism got started in the Catholic Church, then the Lutheran Church, and then the Episcopalian Church, which is the Church of England. And you notice when it started, 1534. And a chart we always use, but now you know how that came about. And so with regard to King Henry, it wasn't so much a love for the Bible. Again, I don't believe personally that his eyes were opened by the prayers of Tyndale. But it was more he wanted what he wanted, and then got upset because he was excommunicated. As a result, you have the Church of England, and as a result of that, then the English Bible, he takes a completely different position than he did before. Now he wants the English Bible to be spread abroad. And so regardless of how that happened or why it happened, the most important thing is it happened. So now we have access to the English Bible because, we might say, of the marriage of Henry, someone has said it was a royal mess. And that's right. Now, as a result of that, it helped the Bible, the English Bible, come along. And so that's what happened with regard to the Great Bible. Now, the Great Bible basically is a revision of a revision, because it's a revision of the Matthew Bible, which itself is a revision. It's because of that that some people didn't trust it all that much. Now, it was hugely popular, but some people didn't really like it and questioned it, because at the end of the day, it was a revision of a revision. And still, remember what this is all about, how this ball got rolling. Well, what is behind all of it? It's people like Wycliffe and Tyndale wanting to get the Bible in the hand of the common people. And so far, that dream hasn't materialized, even though these are great steps forward. There's no doubt about that. And we're just taking it one step at a time, and it's wonderful, and they're great steps. But this great Bible, you see the chain onto it. It was authorized to be placed in every church in England, and it was. But it was chained. It wasn't to leave the various church buildings. It was that. That's what it was for. And people were flocking to the to these buildings, going to services, so that they could hear the Bible read in their own language. In fact, I may have mentioned, maybe not, but a lot of the clergy, so-called clergy, a lot of the preachers didn't like the Bible because people were going to services. They didn't want to hear the preacher preach. They wanted to hear the preacher read the book. That was God's word. And if you stop and think about it, you know, that's not a bad thing. Like now we've kind of flipped, and there's some people who rather hear the preacher preach. And that's why in a lot of places, you know, all the preacher has to get up and give a show. And then you went, but what did he preach? It was dynamic. I know that. I'm edified. I know that. Yeah, but what did he preach? So that's kind of changed to where the preaching itself is more important than what is being preached. Well, at that time, they didn't want the preaching. They just wanted to hear the word and read in their own language. So people were flocking to the... But those Bibles, that's where they were. And it still wasn't legal to have one of those books in your home. So the common man still didn't have access to the word of God. Had more access to it, obviously, could hear it, but didn't have it in their own home. So the dream of giving the common man was still, the Bible was still unfulfilled at this point. But progress is being made. There's something that is very interesting here. This Bible, in 1540, there was a second edition of the Great Bible. And in fact, by 1541, there were six editions to them. And I believe they're all referred to as a Cranmer's Bible. And at least the second edition is, and I believe all six of them are. And it's because this man, Thomas Cranmer, had a preface in it, and you know, whatever it said, they renamed the Great Bible after him. He had nothing to do with the translation at all, but he had the preface in there. And so they called it the Cranmer's Bible. And what's interesting is that in the third and fifth editions, there's a note on the title page that is called it says it's overseen by Tunstall. And Guther Tunstall, I believe his name. But you know who that was? He was the Bishop of London. Now, if you're remembering at all, you remember that in 1523, that's when Tyndale went to London, and he wanted the permission from the Bishop of London to translate the Bible into English. Remember that? What did he say? He said, no, of course not. Not going to lie. I'm not interested in any kind of English Reformation. There's no way you're going to do that. And so that's when he was forced to flee. And basically, for the next 12 years, he did all his work undercover. He was a hunted man on the run and eventually was arrested and lost his life. But now that very Bishop of London is the overseer of two of those translations of a Bible that, for all practical purposes, is Tyndale's translation. How's that for irony? It's pretty interesting how things, in a short period of time, things have completely turned. And so that's just an interesting little point about the Great Bible. Well, then the Geneva Bible, and I think that's where we left off. And remember that was. That came about because you remember who rose to the throne of England? Right. The Bloody Mary. Mary Tudor is and so the Protestants had to flee. And she began to she unleashed in a short period of time. I can't remember how many years her reign was, but it wasn't that many, six or seven, whatever it was. It was short, maybe four or five. But she just unleashed. Her goal was to bring England back to Catholicism and back under the authority of the Pope. And so there's a great persecution. At least 300 Protestants were put to death in a short period of time. And so some of them, like Miles Covendale, John Fox of the, you know, the Book of Martyrs that you read of sometime, John Knox and others, fled to Geneva. And they were safe there. And then finally, after she died, about 2 years after she died, they published this Geneva Bible. And it was published in 1560. You can see it if you you probably can't see that. But 1560 is what it says. Actually, in 1557, the New Testament was completed. And then 3 years later, the Old Testament was completed. And so the complete book was done in 1560. And can't remember how many notes I put up here, but this we'll get to that in a minute. What's interesting about this Geneva Bible, and again, this is just hard to, even when you look at it up close, it's hard to understand exactly what these pole-like things are doing. But the Geneva Bible, it looks like it's pointing to the great, but it's not. It's going through it. If you really look close, you can tell it's going through, all the way down, through all the way down to the Masoretic text. And what the chart is meaning to tell us is that the Old Testament of the Geneva Bible is the first Bible that is based on the Hebrew manuscripts, the ancient Hebrew manuscripts, rather than the Latin Vulgate. So it's the first Bible, English Bible, that it's not translated from Latin, it's translated from Hebrew. With regard to the Old Testament, that's just as significant as having a New Testament translated from Greek. See, and so that's a great plus for the Geneva Bible. But it was hugely popular, and for many years it was the common man's Bible. It was with smaller font. It was a smaller Bible itself. It was really a family Bible. It was meant for individuals in the home. So it was kind of the opposite of the great Bible. The great Bible was meant for the church buildings and, you know, for people. But the Geneva Bible was particularly made in such a way that the common man could read it better. It was clear. It was the first Bible that was put in paragraph form, each verse on its own, you know, own line. Like, that's wonderful. Some of you have, like the ESV almost always doesn't have that. I have one ESV version, I think, where it's like that. And it's a lot easier to preach from. But when it's not like that, you know, the verses are just all together. And when I'm up there preaching, that's why I have to highlight things, because I'm looking now. I see verse 3, but from the life of me, I can't see verse 6. It's in there somewhere. But when they're on separate lines like that, it's just more readable. And Geneva Bible was the first one to do that, the first one to italicize words that weren't in that aren't in the original. So the common man could read that and know, you know, have that information. So the Geneva Bible was a very popular among the populace. It was a very popular Bible and far more popular than the others. And it was so for a long time, even up until I think the last edition of it came in 1644. Now, someone tell me, because I know you know, when was the King James, the first edition of the King James, when was that put out? 1611. So the Geneva Bible was hugely popular all the way up and probably a little bit past 1644. So even after the first edition of the King James Version, the Geneva Bible reigned supreme among the people. And so that's very interesting. And so it was the common man's Bible. It was used by Shakespeare, John Milton, John Bunyan. The colonists at Jamestown had that Bible. It was brought to Plymouth on the Mayflower. So the Pilgrims, that was the Bible that they used. It was the common man's Bible, and it was the Bible that was popular throughout that particular century, and even a little bit after. So it was a hugely popular Bible. Now, the Geneva Bible had a whole lot of notes in it. As I mentioned earlier, it was probably really the first study Bible, because they all had notes in them, some, but the Geneva Bible had a whole lot of notes in them. And so it really had a lean towards Calvinism. And some notes in there that were opposed to the idea of a hierarchy and that sort of thing. And you know, the Church of England continued with almost following the steps of Catholicism, though they were reformed a little bit, not enough in the eyes of a lot of people, like the Puritans. Just they continued to think that the Church of England was compromising, and particularly with the bishops and things. And there were notes in the Geneva Bible that showed that it was opposed to all of that. And so as a result of that, the Church of England decided we needed another translation that kind of leans towards us. And by this time, Queen Elizabeth has arisen to the throne, and she is, she's very Protestant, of course. So the tide has changed with regard to that as well. But she authorizes the Bishop Bible. If I'm not mistaken, the Bishop Bible was dedicated to her. But it was written, it was translated by bishops from the Church of England. A handful of bishops, I read somewhere, 8 bishops, but they were all from the Church of England. And it was all because of the Geneva Bible. They wanted to have the Bishop's Bible that showed their slant. So it was actually a revision of the Great Bible, going back to that. And again, that it was the second authorized Bible. Now again, you know as well as I do, what's the third authorized Bible? The King James. You know, sometimes the King James is just called the authorized version. But it wasn't the first authorized version. It's actually the third, and there was only 3 of them, 3 versions that were authorized by the king or queen or the powers of the Church of England. But so that's the Bishop Bible, and you know, very, very significant. So you can see we're just kind of going up. We're almost to the King James now, and it's hard to see. 1568 is when the Bishop Bible was put out. So, you know, we're just getting closer to what is, of course, what became the most popular version ever, the King James. So, yeah.
I just want to go back a second. I don't know if I'm mistaken on this, but for years you couldn't divorce as a Catholic. They didn't believe in divorce.
Right.
So what they did, you know, to get around that, they started doing annulments.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not 100%. Yeah, one of your Catholics had to tell me that. I don't know exactly when they started that. I'm thinking something that I read that you could get an annulment back then, I believe. Now I could be wrong. I have to look that up. But it just seems.
Same thing as a divorce. I mean,
right.
Just a joke, really.
Right. Yeah. Yes, he had a shot. If you could somehow prove that there was something so-called unscriptural about it, or something. And that's what Henry VIII was trying to do. That he didn't have the right to marry Catherine in the first place, based on the passage in Leviticus there. But I believe, and I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that you know if you could present the proper case. But he didn't have a shot. I mean, they didn't have to think about his at all. the writing was on the wall with him. But yeah, I had to look that up. So yeah, because I don't, you know, again, there's a Catholic in here that knows that, but I'm not quite sure when they started or stopped the annulments. Rick, do you know? Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was the whole problem there. And the Pope was right in that situation, you know. But, of course, you know, the whole idea of an annulment is unscriptural anyway. But, I mean, you know, unless you're in an unscriptural marriage, see. But anyway, I believe they did, I believe they could back then. I just don't know when all of that started. So, all right. So now the only important thing here is that I already said 1568 is when it was published. There was an extensive revision in 1572. The only reason that's important is because that became really the basis that the King James Version used. And really, I won't get into this now, but the Bishop Bible wasn't a great translation. Now, that doesn't mean, don't take that the wrong way. I'm not saying because of that the King James isn't. That's not the case. But you know, those bishops that were chosen to translate the Bishop Bible, they some of their translation was based on the Geneva Bible. One commentary said that the part that they used the Geneva translation was acceptable, but in all other places, I can't remember what the term was, but basically indicated it was terrible. And it was because it was just based on the skill of those eight bishops, which evidently wasn't all that great. So the Bishop Bible itself was kind of, you know, inconsistent and things, and not great things are said about it. But the King James used more than the Bishop Bible, so that's not a knock on the King James. But it did. It did use the Bishop Bible. Well, just quickly, the Reims Douay Bible. That basically it was the Catholic Bible. And what happened with regard to that, it's almost the same as the Geneva Bible, only in the other direction. Remember, with the Geneva Bible, those Protestants were chased out of England. And they were exiled, and so they eventually came up with the Geneva Bible. Well, now that Queen Elizabeth, who's a Protestant in England, ruling over England, now the Catholics are in the minority, and they're chased out of England. So they go to France, and they ultimately produce their own translation. And it was translated, the first part of it was at in the city of Reims in France, and then the Old Testament was translated in a city called Douay, and so put it together, the Reims Douay Bible. But that's the Catholic Bible, and so all the other editions of the Catholic Bible came from that. That's the first Catholic Bible. Now, interestingly, it was translated from the Latin Vulgate. It wasn't, it wasn't translated from the original language at all. No part of it. It was all based on the Latin Vulgate. So the Catholic Bible, again, is a translation of a translation. See? And there you could have, they have in some of their notes, and those who defend the Catholic Bible, I think in the, even with regard to this first edition of it, there's a page or something with 10 points of why they use the Latin Vulgate, and why the Latin Vulgate is superior, even to the original Greek and Hebrew. So it's no accident or anything. They did that on purpose. They wanted a translation from the Latin Vulgate, and they got it, and that's the Catholic Bible. And so that brings us then to the King James Version. And so we'll get into that. Our time is just about up. We'll get into that and how that all came about. And obviously the King James Version is named after the king, King James. He was James VI from Scotland. And then when he rose to the throne, he became James the First. And but he, when he took the throne, the religious world now again is in a mess. A lot in England, there's a lot of friction between the Puritans, the Puritans, and the Church of England, and I mean the friction is high, and so he wants tolerance, and that leads to the ultimately to the King James Version. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and then compare that to the modern translations next week. See what the difference is between them, and then that will be it.